Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Oh, there was a terrible blizzard in the Northeast yesterday. New York did not get the worst of it. My hometown, Boston, nearly had a record snowfall. I think in parts of the area, not where I grew up, they did have a record snowfall. Well, I'm in Chicago. It's above freezing. Some flurries, no flurries today. Some remnants of flurries still on the ground. Nothing to worry about. Anyway, we're live. We're on air. I'm delighted to be with you. John McMurtry is my guest. I'll introduce him in a moment. Just a few comments. Oh, I commented yesterday about the fact that America tries to block truth, its propaganda system, the worst thing that can interfere with an imperial agenda is truth and full disclosure, as I like to say. Well, my goodness, Press TV provides some excellent truth and full disclosure. They have me on often. I commented yesterday on Press TV. Washington, in collaboration with Israel, in collaboration with Britain, in collaboration with other dark forces, blocked Press TV from an iGalaxy satellite service. Earlier, they arranged for Press TV to be blocked on the European service, Eutelsat, on a Spanish service, Hispasat. And it happened again 2 days ago. I tune in online to watch Press TV. I really listen more than watch, but I tune in to follow Press TV daily, 7 days a week. I can't imagine missing a day. They have me on. I mentioned that before. I mentioned yesterday. They let me speak as freely on Press TV out of Tehran, English broadcasting, as I do in this program, as I do in my writing, as I do in any other interview. Today is a very important day in Iran. Press TV had me on twice. Very unusual, but they did. Anybody know what today is? Well, I don't expect to hear an answer, but I'll tell you. Today is the 34th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. It began really on February 1, 1979, when Imam Khomeini came back from exile in Paris. There were 10 days of dawn, culminating on the 10th of February. Iran had a real revolution, not like the fake one in America, not like other fake ones. The one in America I like to describe as everything changed but stayed the same. It really did stay the same. There was only a change of management, but really the policies didn't change all that much. Instead of King George, we had the other King George. That's the way the American system works. Well, Iran got a real revolution, and you can explain it by saying Iranians overwhelmingly supported it. To this day, they overwhelmingly supported it. Can you imagine tens of millions coming out across the country commemorating a particular event? It's never happened in American history. I can't imagine it ever would, unless America really does have a real revolution that it never has had before. Anyway, last year I wrote about the revolution. I wrote about it again this year. Tens of millions on the street commemorating. America does everything it can to subvert Iranian sovereignty, and Iranians thumb their nose at the real evil empire. Anyway, I got to have my say on Press TV. I celebrated the day with them, congratulated them on their important anniversary, and I certainly hope they'll keep their sovereignty. They deserve it. They earned it. They've been struggling to keep it for 34 years. The dark forces in America, Israel, Britain, and the other key NATO allies, all they want to do is subvert legitimacy and impose puppet leadership. Anyway, let me bring John on. John McMurtry, listener, a long time, regular listeners, put it that way. Regular listeners know John well, an extremely distinguished guest. He's written marvelous books, like Unusual Freedoms, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, Value Wars, telling people, readers, and on this program, listeners, what they need to know most. John, welcome.
Good to be back, Steve.
Oh, it's great to have you. I'm glad the weather didn't disrupt us. Got a little nervous here as we approached the top of the hour. But
we got on with by the second. I mean, you were on before I, yes, everything seemed blocked. One of the things, since you're talking about the blockage of Press TV, and I've worried about one of the times when we had a blockage, and I don't know whether you've noticed a constant dot on our line now. That's
Ooh,
what
no, I don't. I don't.
Yeah, I've been getting it at my end. It's just stopped. Yes, that is very interesting. One of the things I was saying to my partner that it's you've got to, in a way, give credit for the tradition of freedom of speech in the U.S. Despite all the assaults on it, they allow something like Press TV. I just said that the day before yesterday. And as you report, they're blocking it, too. And they may try to block, indeed, I was getting this click, click, click going on throughout throughout your short disquisition there.
Well, you know what that means, John. We are being taped by the dark forces I talk about.
No doubt, and I've always thought, because that's been happening with me for many years, ever since I went to Cuba as a young man, it's a pedagogy of for the spooks, is what I think of it. Teach them. They need to be educated, those who listen in. They need to be educated. They know it. Some of them are alert to it. More and more people are being alert to it. And then, I might just use this point, thinking of a guy like George Soros, who you write about. It was something in reading about, there's a conflict. There's a conflict going on. We're reaching a paradigm crisis, a breakdown of the system, and all the symptoms of the breakdown of the system are there. And one of them is, as we've known for a long time, is that those at the top see that something has gone wrong themselves and try to do something in their own way. But the key thing is that they break through the, in a sense, what we have is a this-worldly religion with the transnational money sequence as God, called capital, but it's not even capital. It has none of the similarities to productive capital that began this system. It's a cancer system. And eventually at the top, there begins to be a conflict where people realize something has gone dreadfully wrong. And there's a guy who was a minister of finance and economics and finance for years in Italy from the 90s, and he was a pro-globalist, a guy called Giulio Tremonti, very distinguished man in politics and in economics. And he's saying it's fascism. It is financial fascism. It is white fascism. And then he goes on to say, and it's as if he'd read The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, he goes on to say this system is devouring us. And if it continues on, we are really, you know, in beyond a crisis of crises. So he's acknowledging that as an ex-finance and economics minister of Italy. He's saying it's financial fascism and it's devouring us. Your wonderful new book, The Banker Occupation, which I've since completed, one of the things that stood out for me, and I wanted to go over actually the whole table of contents with you. I know we haven't arranged this, but I wanted to do it because, you know, you keep hitting the button on all these things. And one of the things that really struck me, and it sort of remained with me since, and it only occurs in the middle of the book when you talk about George Soros, who everybody will know is the man who speculates against currencies and makes up to $1 billion a day, making them fail, and of course at the cost of the financial bases of public sectors, and he's done it across the world from Britain and elsewhere. And he gives a quote that you cite that has really fascinated me, and what he says, because, you know, he is referred to in the Atlantic Monthly, he is referred to capitalism, and this goes back some years now, to over 10 years ago, he was saying that we're in danger of a totalitarian capitalism. He recognized something deeply wrong, and he also recognized that the financial system was in a state of disorder and had to have some corrections. He was never very clear on it. Usually the corrections are pretty minor things. And he has gone on speculating and going on reaping billions of dollars at the expense of public sectors across the world. Well, he gives it well, one speaking out of one side of his mouth, but I think this is a real internal conflict that's incarnating itself through George Soros. He's saying this system is deranged. I mean, he uses quite strong language, not that exact word, on the one hand. And on the other hand, he says, as a participant in the market, I have no responsibility for the consequences of my action. As a participant, and I've put that to memory because it so exemplifies what's gone, the moral rot at the core of this system. That as long as you play it within the system, you have no responsibility for the consequences of your action. So it is diabolical by its very expressed nature. You have no responsibility for the consequences of your action. No one says that. No one says that unless they're part of a fanatic cult. And or if they lived in prehistoric times where you thought the gods were giving you commands, but it isn't any of those things. It's understood that you have no responsibility for your actions inside this system. Well, what does take responsibility for actions? Nothing does, because the invisible hand of the market or the market god or the capitalist god, the invisible hand will take care of everything. It will optimize all consequences automatically. Now, this is the thought system of fanaticism, which goes actually beyond jihadists of Islamic nature, in the sense that, you know, they you know, Allah Akbar, God's doing everything through me, and, you know, I'm blowing up you, and I'm blowing up myself, and I shall end up in paradise, and so forth. They at least take responsibility for the consequences of their action. They die. This system and the people at the top of it take no responsibility for their actions. And that's why they can go on doing what they do, and what they have is the supreme moral objective, and the supreme moral objective, we've gone on it before, as expressed by Rockefeller, is to replace the auto-determination or self-determination of past centuries with a transnational, they doesn't call it that, they call it the free market or whatever, you know, the mask for it, which is the god, and it's transnational money sequences multiplying themselves without limit and at the expense of all life organization, so that every system, every living system is in decline over 30 years and no refereed account of anything will disconfirm that actual result. But that actual result we're not responsible for. Nobody's responsible for it. And so whatever happens, everybody goes back into, well, you know, you have to protect America's interests. What are America's interests? They're transnational money sequences across the world, multiplying themselves to the expense of everything that lives on Earth, to the expense of the poor who grow poor, to the expense of the 99%, essentially, as the new recognition has learned. And, well, we have no responsibility for the consequences of our actions, because the actions go through the god. And the god is the market, the so-called market, though it's got nothing in common with the market that Adam Smith spoke about. And so you have, in short, a god system that has no responsibility for the consequences of actions of any individual in it. And that's why they're always saying, well, there must be many sacrifices. You know, the sacrifices that people are called on to make never end. This is why people are always, you know, being punished by the market and not taking attention to the market. The God will do the punishment, the God will do the rewards, and we have no responsibility for anything, and the world can collapse in front of our eyes. And that's the way it is. Because this God, this worldly God, this transnational money sequence cancer is above all else. It's an uber alles logic that beggars the mind, you know, staggers the imagination how far it's gone. It's worse than anything I've seen, and I study value systems through history. I've never seen one like that. And so the conflict that goes on, whatever is going on, you're talking, well, maybe I better just leave it there for you, Steve, on this conflict that's going on inside the elite who still have any thinking, like Soros. And you might say Bill Gates is another example, but what does he do? He just promotes GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which I'm not going to go in again into all the problems of them. One of the results is all the Indian suicides that are going on at farmers in India. And, you know, it has ecological contamination and so forth. But nobody ultimately has to worry because we're not responsible for the consequences of our action. We just do what the market tells us to do, and what the market tells us to do in the new cancer capitalism is to multiply our money sequences, period. End of story. That's it. That's the way the world is ruled.
Yeah, it really is a very sad situation, John. It's hard to find words to describe what they're talking about and how they try to justify it. The last two programs, we talked about John Brennan's testimony and how he justified targeted killing, extrajudicial killings. And I wrote several times about Brennan, and he got softball questions from the Senate Intelligence Committee in his confirmation hearing. And he had the audacity, and senators had more audacity, to accept the fact that he told them, well, you know, we do these things because we want to prevent future killings. And obvious questions that should have been asked never were, like, how in hell do you know somebody plans to kill anybody? I mean, if you kill them and you don't ask them, you'll never know what they had in mind. I mean, maybe they were just going to the store to buy a bottle of milk or something, and you decided they were off to kill somebody, so you kill them to prevent killing. And Brennan made that statement, and the senators on the committee gobbled it up and accepted it. And before the committee began, I spotted a Washington Post headline with the committee chairwoman, Dianne Feinstein, one of the richest members of the Senate, her own wealth and her husband's wealth. She described John Brennan, this killer, this murderer, she described him as, quote-unquote, remarkable. John, what can you say?
Well, all your listeners know, of course, he's the founder of the drone program,
right,
which is a serial mass murder program without any, I mean... It not only overrides the due process of law and overrides the whole basis of English-speaking law, the Magna Carta, everything. It overrides, it just dismisses out of hand. They don't even know who the targets may be. I mean, it's just that they're in a position that they suspect might be in a state of enmity to them, and therefore they kill them. I mean... I don't know whether you remember an old cartoon, I guess gallows humor coming in, an old cartoon of Al Cap, and there was a character called Fearless Fosdick in it.
Oh, I sure remember.
And that somebody might be eating a poison can of beans, and therefore you had to kill them first. And this really is, this is like, at the gallows humor level, it's like Fearless Fosdick. They're going to kill people that they suspect might be against them because of the position they hold inside a framework that they've constructed that points to them, and they don't even know who they are, basically.
Well, John, I wrote about a study conducted by Stanford University and New York University, and data that they collected showed that 98% of the people killed by the drone attacks are non-high-level targets. What they're really saying is,
yeah,
most of those 98% are innocent men, women, children, yeah, and infants. I mean, two well-known universities, Stanford, NYU. My God, this is their conclusions. Well, you certainly don't have the New York Times or anybody else talking about this or featuring it, but it is shocking and very disturbing, John. The title of my new book, the subtitle of my new book, Waging Financial War on Humanity. You can wage wars on people lots of different ways. You can wage hot wars, the way Brennan and the others are doing it, part of the wars on Afghanistan, Pakistan, the rest of them. Drone strikes can go anywhere. You know, I mean, they can have troops on the ground, special forces killing people. They can have drones killing people. Well, that's in the hot war package. Financial wars, I mean, financial wars can be more destructive than hot wars.
Well, they're all linked, of course. the hard wars, the hot wars, are for the financial money sequences in the transnational corporate form.
For sure.
So they're linked, like joined at the hip. And so you're right. It's not just that there's two types of war. I mean, Dulles long ago, Foster Dulles long said there's two ways of waging war, and the people, one is by force of arms, and the other is by financial means. And he might have added, or we can add, and they're joined at the hip. They have the same objective, and the objective is to multiply transnational money sequences to more overall life organization, whatever that stands in the way. And what you get with, by the way, those drone missiles were originally tested, and years ago they were tested in one form or another in Canada on the prairies, and I did all I could to expose them, and there was a public outcry of a kind that occurred on that in that period. But that's where it comes to roost eventually, is through these tiny, I mean, they can be, they're as big as your fist. They can come to any neighborhood near you and just kill you or kill anybody around you. They have no way of pinpointing, as those studies you just identified. And you just think, this is beyond belief. This is worse than Nazism in a way, because at least they had to cross borders. At least they had to face resisting armies. This is just being able to kill whoever you want, as you please, without any legal process whatsoever. So in a way, you can see it as the collapse of Western civilization, the collapse of the rule of life protective law, the very things we stand for in the name of Western civilization. But what worries me, Steve, is that they say that this is a popular program with the American people. And that worries me, that it might be popular with the American people, that we have a culture that is developed there. And of course, it follows suit, but not a... We haven't developed what I would call the ultimate credo of American civilization, as it is the dark side, is I kill, therefore I am. We kill, therefore we are. Therefore we are number one. And that we can do that without any deaths to us, without risk of injury to any of our boys or women, is just what this culture has grown to have a taste for. And that becomes, you know, we really are seeing the rot at the core of the whole civilization expressing itself as it does in these cases through the murder of other people, and remains popular, worse than the Colosseums in Rome, where they threw, you know, captives to the, you know, made them war against each other and other animals and so on, that we have a much worse thing going on here, and the crowd loves it. It's a spectacle sport. They love it.
What really is, John? I think the difference between...
What do you think, though, Steve, if the whole culture has gone? I mean, what percentage is? I mean, I hear it over and over again. This is a very popular program with the American people, and I can believe it. I mean, that's... Do you think it's true, first of all? Do you think it's true that it is popular with the American people?
I don't know that it's necessarily popular, John, except in the sense that it's a lot better to send drones and leave your family, friends, and neighbors at home, not on the battlefield. Of course, they're still there, but there are few in numbers of them there.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's a lot safer. The casualty count for Americans is a lot lower. But then you wonder, I'll put out an article tomorrow called Record Numbers of U.S. Military and Veteran Suicides. Almost 20 veterans in America of America's wars, the Iraq War, the Afghan War, almost 20 of them every single day commit suicide.
I didn't know that.
I mean, that is absolutely astonishing.
No.
They're still sending a lot of troops over there. Doesn't get a lot of press.
Or they'll continue.
And they'll continue doing it. Smaller numbers, but they keep going over. There are multiple deployments. It wears on them. You go out.
And these are professional soldiers, too. These aren't drafted people. I mean, they're forced into it through poverty.
They're forced into it through poverty. They go because they can't find another job. They don't need a draft because the economy is so weak. But these kids go over, they come back traumatized, and these horrendous numbers take their own lives on a daily basis, and active duty forces take their lives. They're given rotten treatment when they get any, when they go in for emotional treatment, PTSD, or whatever name you want to give it. They're delayed for months, sometimes years. They don't get what they desperately need, and it weighs on them over time. And if you compound that in a weak economy and you can't find a job, a lot of these kids end up taking their own lives. You've got that. But as far as Americans thinking drones are popular, well, you know, they don't hear too many stories or headlines about the war and soldiers and body bags and the rest.
No,
well,
that's
better
right.
to send a drone if it gets shot down.
Surgical
well, it's a drone.
Strike,
there's
yeah.
nobody in it. Kids don't die. In that respect, it's popular. Of course, the difference between that and the Coliseum, John, is people filed into the stadium to watch the event like a football game here. Nobody watches the drone attacks except the drone operators.
Yeah.
And the people on the ground being targeted.
Yeah. So it's so clinical and so technologically decoupled from the victims. That's what's new, really, isn't it?
Oh, it really is.
And with no risk at all. You know, Bertrand Russell years ago said this, that people in airplanes, and he was talking about, you know, the wars of his day, he said that they're natural fascists. It's, fascism is built into the disconnect from the victims. You don't see anything but colored lights. You don't see anything but grids. And so it's back to the air bombing. You might even say, well, it is the air bombing. It's another form of the air bombing, which, by the way, you know, the Soviet Union wouldn't bomb civilian centers. Everybody said how odious, you know, the evil empire and the rest of it. Whereas the U.S., has been into bombing civilian centers from the beginning, and of, you know, the stage that we're talking about from 1939 on. And we just get more and more sort of diabolical forms of doing it. Bombing people from a distance where you do not see the victims, you destroy their lives completely and those around them, and you don't even, well, as the civilians, and you know, 90% of all the casualties and deaths of today's wars, over 90% are civilians. That doesn't matter. It doesn't even matter if they're guilty. It doesn't even matter if you know who they are. As long as you can do it simply, swiftly, and clinically, you can kill whoever you want. And so we see the collapse of the moral core of Western civilization led by the U.S. And one of the things that I thought to myself, so I'm slightly changing topic, but just reflecting on these things, you see this intervention that's going on in Mali. And you think, to begin with, oh, well, thank God, we've got a bombing or, you know, an action that's taking place that's not led by the U.S., but the U.S. is right in, well, I mean, it's actually led by the U.S., France is at the front face of it. And they're, you know, they're taking on the jihadists who are actually making people's lives totally miserable. Doesn't seem to be any issue of that. And they're making them run, and they're using them with this high-powered airborne weaponry and so forth. And you think, well, here's one place possibly, because you know, Steve, though we're very hard. I know both of us hope for something better. And then you look into it and you find out, well, actually, these jihadists are people who have been trained and led, and they're led by U.S. and Algerian secret forces, covert forces, who are actually the leaders of them. They're the leaders of these jihadists. They are planted in by not only, but Algeria, its president and Bush made a deal back in, I guess, 2004 or something, that they were going to ally with each other. And the way they allied with each other, and Algeria is using the same method. They say they're fighting terrorism and they're fighting jihadists. In fact, they're leading the jihadists. They're leading the terrorists. I hear the music come on, and perhaps we'll return to Mali.
Oh, indeed. John, we'll take a short break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back on with John McMurtry. John, there's never a shortage of things going on in the world, and unfortunately most of them are bad. People ask me once in a while, why don't you say something about the good things that are happening? And my usual comment is, if I ever spot any, I'll absolutely say something about it. So hard. I mean, I'm talking about the major things. I mean, there are lots of good things that happen. There are good people. They do good things. They help people instead of hurt them. But the major things, wars instead of peace, corporate empowerment instead of fairness, money power running everything instead of a level playing field helping everybody, these are the major things. And I can't see anything going on that gives me hope to be able to comment that, gee, it's so wonderful to see these things. And you're on these issues, and I try to stay on them too. It's very, very depressing. But the only thing you can do is to point them out and encourage people to take careful note of what's happening and always point out that unless we do something from the bottom up, this stuff is just going to go on and get worse. And we both agree, John, there's nothing worse than money power. It really, talk about money being the root of all evil. If there ever was an understatement, I think it's that. I mean, it literally controls everything.
Well, I'm going to go again and insist upon the distinction between the old money powers and this money power as a full-on global cancer, because it's transnational, and everything now is being run and increasingly run through it, so that if you don't turn money into more money for the private money sequences that are controlled basically about by seven power money sequence transnational money sequence centers in the world, nothing like this has ever occurred before. Then you don't exist. You don't have a right to exist in this system. And the actual line was from the man who originally proposed, you know, was a globalist himself, this fellow Giulio Tremonti, who was the Minister of Economics and Finance. He says the financial market based upon a powerful and dominating ideology, which I'd say is all about the transnational money sequences as God, which tends towards the annihilation of the best part of human nature. Now, remember, this is a guy who's a minister of state and who was part of the leadership of this globalization movement, a cheerleader for it, and he's realizing the annihilation of the best part of human nature, and I might add of all of nature, reducing to the economic sphere to finance, and devouring us, and eventually devouring itself. That's what I was alluding to earlier. And again, I think one of the hopeful signs is that there's this conflict. These people, there's a wake up now. Now, this has been going on for 30 years. You know, it's basically started, as we know, with the Reagan era and Thatcher on the other side of the ocean, and where society does not exist. That's the ideology, you see. Nothing exists but basically what these transnational money sequences, and anything in the way is destroyed. And so it's not just the money power, it's the cancerous transnational money sequences with no limit, with no institutional limit built to resist them, of a national sort, of a socially developed sort, of an evolved civil common sort. Nothing is allowed to resist it. So it's different from the money power that for example, the founders of the American Republic themselves, people like Jefferson recognized the money power is more dangerous than standing armies. It's much worse, because now it's global. Now it controls everything. You try to find anything. You try to find anything in our whole so-called economy that isn't ultimately responsible. It doesn't owe debt to the money power. I'm using it myself, to the transnational money sequences centered in Wall Street. Try to find any store you go into, any home you go into, who doesn't owe money to this system that doesn't perform any function. So it is totalitarianized, and that's what makes it different from just the money power. It's a cancerous attack that's now affecting the whole globe. And when you go to, just back to the Mali one, when you go to the Mali one, and I was thinking, well, you know, this seems, at least we're seeing some good come out of, you know, the more advanced weaponry of the West. Well, the jihadists, and this is the same as going on in Syria. This is why, where I wanted to get to. The same is going on in Syria. The jihadists themselves are led by Western special forces and plants. And what they do, what happened in Mali, and you know, it's, in a way it's worse, what happened in Mali was that the north part of Mali, by the way, these are all areas that I've traveled in, the north part of Mali in the Algerian, you know, the Sahara Desert, basically, is the Tuareg people, and they, you know, they're a people who have been very much oppressed by the French and by the Algerians in their place, and they're just, you know, they have oil, as always. They have minerals, you see. They have very, very valuable minerals. They have uranium. They have found, just discovered in Mali, surprise, surprise, because it's always after the treasure. It's always after the people's natural resources to take it from them. And so how are you going to take it from them? Because now the Mali people in the Tuareg people have uprisen, and they have a Tuareg revolutionary liberation movement of the old sort, where they're going to declare their own sovereignty, and they're going to run things in a way that actually benefits the people instead of it just being a looting basin for the U.S. and Europe. So what are we going to do about that? That's when Bush and the president of Algeria, who's in a state of disgrace because of his death squads and so forth, and because of economic problems, they get together and decide what we're going to do about it is we're going to have a jihadist group. We're going to send them in there, and we're going to lead them in there, and they're going to, because they're death squatters, just what's going on in the last program we were together, you were very distressed, understandably, about their death squads. There are death squads in Syria, and that's who's doing the damage, and that's what all the atrocities are actually being generated by the death squads, and they themselves are led by the special forces. They are plants. And this is what happened in Mali. And, of course, normal people aren't able to deal with it. They have advanced weaponry. They're psychopathic. They're leading psychopaths on one hand. And on the other hand, they're using that as a justification to destroy the actual liberation movement. They put the blame on them as terrorists when they themselves have installed the terrorists in there to destroy them. They blame them. Always the reverse projection. I've mentioned it over and over again. Always the reverse projection. Always you project onto the adversary or who you want to destroy what you're doing yourself is the reason for attacking them. And so that's what they do to the revolutionary movement. Blame them for the terrorism that they themselves have constructed. Then destroy the liberation movement and leave in charge their own plants, who are the actual terrorists. And then what you have is basically what happened was that the terrorists, the jihadists who had been constructed and led, now they're not all Western stooges any more than Bin Laden was a Western stooge. They just get financed, armed, and led by them. And so as soon as the French army came in, they quickly retreated and so forth. But they're just going to go back and do the same thing. And then we're going to have, and on all that uranium will now come into French and U.S. hands, because the U.S., as you always recognize, is behind it all. And they're going to get all the uranium we want, but also the gold. Like, they are the third highest gold. You know, Africa's a great looting basin for minerals. And gold is very strong. They have significant oil, of course, as well, and more coming on hand. And as soon as that starts to be visible, then this whole game happens again. We've got it over and over and over again. We've seen it happen in Iraq. We've seen it happen in Afghanistan. We saw it happen in Afghanistan. You know, that was how they destroyed the government there. They actually had a socialist government there. that you know, was a primitive one, but at least women had equality. They all went to school. They had social. They had, you know, all the social benefits of free health care and free education for all, and so forth. And then they used the jihadist as the weapon against the socialist power in there to destroy it, and then say that's all they're, you know, we're doing a national liberation. These are people that are like our founding fathers and the rest of it, fighting against the oppressive enemy. And then, of course, that is their own construction, and then that construction, as happens again and again, becomes the next enemy, because you always have to have an enemy in order to attack, to justify taking everything that people have. And that's what's gone on in Mali too. And I just look at myself thinking maybe a good thing has happened here. And then you start to research, and that's the wonderful thing, of course, about the internet, is that you can research these things. But actually, it came out in a journal called The New Internationalist. It was in an older journal what was happening in Mali before all this happened, that this was actually predicting what was going to happen. And here we have it again. And here we have it in Syria again. We're going to, you know, once they get the special forces into Iran, now, of course, I think that's why Iran, like the Soviet Union, it's surrounded. They're trying to get the special forces in. And I was going to say to you, why do you think, you know, there was that liberation movement. By the way, I've been in Iran before the revolution, and I was in Berkeley when the revolution was happening. And there was a tremendous movement of Iranian people who were not actually jihadists, who were not actually Islamic fanatics, the way it's all turned out. They were secular, rational, socialist inclined people. And the Shah had SAVAK, you know, torture squads and all the rest of it, and had gold toilet seats. You know, he was a quintessential corrupt despot tyrant that the U.S. always favors. And they had an actual revolution. The Mujahideen, who were the original rebels, were actually very, and there was Kurdish presence there too, were very kind of an intellectually advanced group who had secular, social, democratic ideas. And then it all got changed over to, as we know, a mullah despotism. But the mullah, that, and I wanted to ask your opinion of that. What do you think of that? Because from what I hear from people who are Iranian, and I've had graduate students and so forth, that is the Iranian mullah despotism is pretty hard to take. But then they were surrounded, like the Soviet Union was surrounded, by an enemy power that wants to destroy them, that will do anything to destroy them. If they can ever get anybody in there, if they can ever get special forces in there, if they can ever corrupt people to overthrow or, you know, start the same thing that's happened in Syria, it'll happen. And so you have them operating in a way where they have to become military dictators in order to defend themselves against what's going to happen to them, just as it's happened to everybody else. And they have to have a dictatorship in order to do it. But I wonder whether that change that happened in the Iranian Revolution itself, and those people who were really progressive were destroyed. Have you any thoughts on that, on the Iranian thing? We know what the problem is. We know what they're going to do. They're going to do the same thing as they did in Syria. They're going to do what they did in Iraq, what they did in Afghanistan, what they're doing in Mali, and on we go. What do you think internally with Iran, that change that happened from a progressive, because it all started, you remember, with Mossadegh in 1954 or 53, he was overthrown by the U.S., though he led a very advanced socially grounded party. It wasn't socialist, but it was social democratic, decent, intellectual, and so forth. He was overthrown way back then. And people murdered, just like next door, or in Indonesia, they killed a million people. But now the transformation happened in Iran itself from a progressive people's movement that won the revolution that you were just celebrating, that is today is the anniversary of, but something happened in Iran too. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think you say a lot of things that make sense, John. As far as Mossadegh goes, secular society, democratic society, the CIA's first coup, Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, it took him two tries to get Mossadegh out. Miraculously, they didn't kill him. He stayed alive. And now you've got the Iranian Revolution. What strikes me, John, is that I absolutely prefer a secular government to a religious one. But you look at what goes on. Literally tens of millions of Iranians come out on the street every year, and they commemorate the anniversary of this. I don't think anybody forces them to go out. I think they go out on the streets because they largely support what's going on. That really impresses me a great deal. As far as their political system goes, Imam Khomeini, he and I guess the other key imams around him, they decide who can run or not run for office. And I guess they do it a little bit the way that it's done in Cuba, where they don't want a corrupt system coming back into power the way things were in Cuba in the 1950s and earlier, and the way they were under the Shah. So they have just reasons to be concerned. So they pick the candidates who they think will preserve the revolution, and then they have a process that I must say, I wrote about the 2009 election, and I must say, if you compare the process once the candidates are chosen, and the process in America is the same thing. Instead of the imams choosing the candidates in Iran, you get the party bosses doing it in America.
Well, the transnational money sequences. Yeah.
That's right. You got the money boys. You got Wall Street. You got big oil.
Both
you got
sides.
The rest of them. They're the ones who choose the candidates, except it's secular and it's not religious. But once you get to the actual process, the Iranian process is more democratic than the American one. I wrote the one in about the one in 2009. You simply can't compare what they did to what goes on in America, and that impresses me. So whatever is going on, John, I think the people largely support it. I'll yield to them. If they're happy with the system, why should I complain about it?
Well, it's not, you know, it's not wise, I gather, to express this, you know, opposition to the system. You know, the real tragedy of it, Steve, is that when I traveled through these lands, there was Arab socialism was the thing. It was a secular Arab socialist state was winning all over the place. Remember Nasser?
Oh, I sure do.
Yeah. And he was a hero of that whole movement, and you know, again, it was over foreign imperial control of their basic assets and exploiting the people and so forth, and they uprise against them. And that whole, you see, though I could say I'm myself a God-fearing man, I don't much have not seen many religious. Although I guess the Dalai Lama is a kind of God king. You don't see very successful structures of modern governance that are by where the state power and the religious power have become unified in a kind of a theocracy. But then the theocracy itself was brought on, just like as in Afghanistan. I mean, there was Arab socialist movements happening everywhere in Iran, Egypt, Syria, and, you know, still Iraq to some extent. That was what they wanted to get rid of. And so all of this theocratic, the thing that I'm questioning now, this theocratic government where we have a mullah dictatorship, is all been constructed itself. It's a construction. They're fighting what they constructed, which is the standard thing. They construct the enemy and then attack it for the reasons that they are doing themselves. And in fact, the enemy itself has been constructed by them. And so, you wonder about, you see, there are people from Iran. I just was briefly visiting with someone who had just come back from Iran. She's a scientist, and she was saying it was, you know, it was really, things were just getting worse and worse there because of the embargo, and, you know, and of course, all of that just plays into the hands of, I mean, you have some tyrannical behaviors going on there. When you have a God-king kind of structure, you have some very terrible, dogmatic, prescriptive, overriding, murderous things going on. But all of that is being strengthened by the embargo, strengthening by the constant attacks, because then those forces, because those tens of millions of people on the street, if they had a free choice of really whether they had a government that was truly in their interest, they might well choose a democratic and, you know, not a cancer system. But that's why you want to keep the theocracy in power in order to justify the reason to attack it, to seize their oil. I mean, it's just, and seize their assets. I mean, they seize their assets all over the place. And you know, the worst figure in all of this is Canada. You should hear it, this little barking chihuahua, just barking for sanctions, barking for invasions, these, you know, right-wing Wall Street types, you know, branch planters.
You're talking about Stephen Harper? Stephen Harper, John.
Yes, Stephen Harper, but, you know, his that whole gang. They're a gang. They're a corporate gang.
Oh, the whole gang. You hear that music, John? That means I've got 60 seconds to end the program.
Sorry, Steve.
let me wrap up. I hate to cut you off. I have no choice. The clock is ruthless. Ruthless. It's the boss. Many, many thanks, John. I look forward to next month to getting you back. I've got just about enough time to thank you and to remind listeners that we're on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. John, it was another great hour. It's always enlightening for me as well as listeners. Again, I look forward to having you back. Well, I do manage to get a lot out, John. We'll talk next month, and I love to end the program by telling listeners, make it a regular habit.